to you a little bit about methodology, because it's important to understand a little bit about what the Beis Din of America does concretely. I've been privileged to be involved with the Beis Din for more than a decade. I was the director for a while. I've been a diet of the cover for various titles for the past 10 years. The Beis Din of America, more or less, hears three different kinds of cases. It hears end of marriage cases with all of its difficulties, both the giving and receiving of a get, as well as the division of assets. It hears commercial disputes between parties that come to Beis Din of an incredible variety, large and small. And it also adjudicates community disputes between institutions that disagree in one form or another about matters that involve allocation of resources or even personnel, and we serve a function of resolving disputes within however you want to go about defining it, our community. And these are the three basic tasks that the Beis Din of America does. At the end, every matter is a case, and you have to resolve cases that are in front of you and not just think about them in abstract theoretical principles. So before we talk about concrete cases, I want to start by following up on something Rabbi Willard said, which is a very, very, very crucial analytic question. The question is, in what circumstances does the Beis Din of America defer to secular law and incorporate the results that would be reached in secular law in the hearings in front of a Beis Din? This is a very important analytic question, and it's also an exceptionally important practical question. Obviously, Halakha recognizes that commercial law, both Jewish and secular, has an element of contract and agreement to it, and that what determines the proper law in most contract dispute cases is what the parties intended as they reached the agreement governing their case. This is not true in most areas, certainly core areas of family law, but it's definitely true in many contract disputes, and it's definitely true in parts of the end of marriage dispute as well. And it's important to understand that as you think about how a Beis Din goes about functioning, you have to recognize that an enormous amount of what a Beis Din does, if it's to function successfully in our world, is recognize that even religious Jews, even when they engage in disputes among each other, nonetheless frequently accept that secular law provides the modus vivendi for those disputes. And just to understand, let me give you an example. A person runs a supermarket. Now, secular law in the United States is as follows. When I run a supermarket and you come into my supermarket and you pick up a can of spaghetti, you hold it in your hand and you look at it, and it accidentally slips from your hand and falls to the ground and it breaks. What's the norm in the United States? What happens? You broke it, you bought it. The supermarket does not charge you for the food that you drop at all. It comes and cleans up the mess and you go on your merry way. That's the reality. There's a technical reason for it, consistent with what we call the UCC. But whatever the explanation is, this is the model that happens when you step into a supermarket anywhere in the United States. Jewish law, on the other hand, is fairly clear. You step into a supermarket, you put your hands in a can of spaghetti, you pull it from the shelf, you drop it, you bought it. Now, when I'm running my supermarket, I could hang up a sign which says, if you're a Gentile and you break it, it's on the house. But if you're a grown Jew like me, you better come to the front and pay. But already the shock notes 500 years ago that in a place where commerce is done in an integrated way, where Jews and Gentiles are doing business, merchants don't conduct themselves this way. In fact, they like to have only one set of rules that govern transactions and not have to use a colloquialism, check the census of people to determine what legal system applies in any given case. And there are obvious good reasons why that social convention occurs, and the shock notes, and many have noted that this is true, of the society around them, even if it's inconsistent with Jewish law. This is why Rabbi Feinstein accepts rent control as valid in New York City, or commercial bankruptcy, or many other aspects of secular law. So one of the things that Beis Din has to do is it has to stop and ask itself what's on the minds of the parties as they go about engaging in their commercial transactions. It can't just open up the Shulchan Aruch and answer questions of Jewish law as if that itself is sinful. But it also has to ask itself, as the parties negotiated their transaction before they engaged in the sale, was their intent to be governed by Jewish law, or had they put a huge condition on the sale, which is that the sale was going to be conducted according to secular law? I guess I'll take a question, but we're going to run out of time quickly.
Very quickly. Is this custom or is it law that the Gentile supermarket doesn't charge it for the...
From a Jewish law perspective, it doesn't matter. It's not important. From a Jewish law perspective, it's sufficient to know that that's the common commercial norm out there, and that would be the way we thus go about doing business. The fault line between these two sometimes is when you have a secular law that's not at all obeyed, and how do you go about functioning in a legal system in that model? That's a fascinating question, but not for here and now. There's a handout in front of us. Let's just do them. Can I get a reading volunteer? My loss, please, thank you. A high school.
Okay. A high school is missing the teacher because the job opened in another high school in the area during the summer before school. The teacher approached another teacher and told that second teacher that he could apply for the job in the other school, and the other school is a much nicer place to work. And induced the second teacher to breach her contract with the school, leaving the first school one teacher short. They addressed that problem by raising the pay of each of the remaining teachers and making each of them work one extra period. Prior to the raise, the first teacher made $52,000. After the raise, the teacher's latest makes $61,000. When the first school found out that this first teacher had told the second teacher that the other school was an extra place to work, they encouraged the second teacher, who was already under contract with the first school, to apply for the job in the second school. They took that as an act of disloyalty and fired the first teacher on the spot. When the first teacher sought unemployment payments, as they were now unemployed, the first school did not note the true reason why they were fired, but instead stated that the first teacher was fired for absenteeism. This caused the first teacher to be denied unemployment benefits worth $30,000. The school and the first teacher are each suing each other in big team. The second teacher is not a party, but is a witness. Neither side is currently seeking damages for the second teacher.
So the first question confronted a simple fact pattern like this is, was the first teacher's conduct in approaching another member of the faculty and saying, I wouldn't work here where we're both working, I would work over there. That's a much better place to work than here. A violation of the first teacher's duty to their employer. And the simple answer to this question, which is not only the simple answer, but the right answer, is that when you're an employee for an organization, as a matter of Jewish law, you owe your employer a duty of loyalty, which is not to undermine the business that your employer engages in, again, adding the obvious caveat that it's a lawful business engaged in proper ethical conduct, all of which are reasonable things to talk about when you talk about a day school or a high school. Not talking about selling heroin on 182nd Street, we're talking about a day school. And so the first teacher's conduct by saying to the second teacher, I wouldn't work where you're working, I would go work someplace else, that's a violation of the duty of loyalty that every employee owes to every employer. And because it's a violation, termination for cause at that point is proper.
This loyalty business, does it extend to sending your child to that school?
It all depends on the ground rule. A school certainly can say to its teachers, we will not hire faculty who don't send their children to the school. But at the very least, it clearly extends to not going to another member of the faculty and saying, you should leave here and go work someplace else. That's a fireable offense. On the other hand, that's not the issue in front of the school, in front of the case to some extent. The question is, the school then turned around, and as they filled out their unemployment form, they didn't repeat the truth. They instead repeated a falsehood. Why did they repeat this falsehood? Perhaps because unemployment.com what was actually happening here, which is that they lost a faculty member to another school because one teacher in their own school said the other school is a better place to work. And maybe they don't want to put that in writing because it's true. Because it's true. It's true. I mean, even when it's true, when you work for a company and somebody says to you, are these bananas delicious? You're not allowed as an employee to say, no, the bananas in the store down the block are both cheaper and better. You're just not allowed to say that. And that's a violation of your duty of loyalty as an employee in almost every situation. So the school puts a lie in writing so as to not put the truth, which perhaps they felt denigrated the teacher, denigrated the school, would create a buzz of malicious gossip, difficult as it is to believe that Jews ever gossip about things that run in the school system. So they put down a falsehood. Was this falsehood material? Not sure. Maybe this falsehood was not at all material because the first grounds was also proper grounds for termination, which if they had put down, would have also been grounds for denial of unemployment. And this requires a quick look to see whether it in fact is. Assuming this act of disloyalty is grounds for termination as well, although the school did wrong, putting down the wrong reason was not material for the denial of unemployment to the first teacher. Whether the truth had been written or some other reason had been written, the teacher's termination would have been correct, and the denial of unemployment would have been proper as well. So I think when you think about this as a classical financial dispute between the parties, you'd say that the school's decision to write down the wrong information was not proper, but it was also not material to what happened to this teacher in this case, and this teacher was correctly dismissed for cause, having violated the duty of loyalty owed to her employer. And this case, by the way, I don't think materially resolves itself differently in Bezdin or in secular court. The resolution in both of these is identical. The difference between a Bezdin and a secular court in this case probably is Bezdin is much faster and incredibly, incredibly cheaper. Please. No, why not you?
Duty of loyalty, like scrapping in case of small talk that's not a violation of this duty of loyalty?
The answer is we could spend a great deal of time on the duty of loyalty, but at the very minimum, it requires that you not go to other employees and encourage them to leave. The question of where exactly the parameters of the duty of loyalty is a good one. I don't know exactly where it lies, and this produces complexity in October, but when you go to a fellow worker and say you should quit, even though you're under contract and go someplace else, you have violated the duty of loyalty. That I'm 100% sure.
Looking at the quote, the other school is a much nicer place to work. That's all we have.
You're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed, it's like you're selling bananas for a supermarket. Somebody comes in and says, are the bananas here good? And you say, the bananas over there are better. You're not allowed as an employee of an organization selling bananas to say the bananas over there are better. That seems 100% clear. That's a violation of your duty of loyalty. You can say, I don't comment. But when you step into a restaurant and you say to the waitress, what's good here? And the waitress says, nothing. So that's a fireable offense. Or the waitress says, things are good here, but everything is better across the street. So that's a fireable offense. Of course it is.
Why would that be a fireable offense unless that was spelled out when the person was hired?
Because it's understood in Jewish law and in American law that there's a general obligation of loyalty to your employer even when it's not spelled out. It's typical in almost all contracts that contracts do not spell out obvious provisions as a matter of Jewish law or as a matter of secular law. There are certain provisions in an employment arrangement that just rebound on every single employment relationship, one of which is the duty of loyal dealings. This is true in American law. This is true in Jewish law. If I had to stop to guess, I would say this is true in every legal system. That's something an employer has to do. Something an employer has to do, it's something an employee has to do. Just like there's a general obligation in Jewish law for a duty of fair dealing. The duty of fair dealing. One more question on this case.
How about the negotiation with trade unions against the employer, and they conspire with each other to go out and strike if they
So I want to deal with the details of unions. Unions are governed by a very specific statute, but when you hire an employee, you bear a duty of some loyalty to that employee, and the employee bears a duty of some loyalty to the employer. That's just an obvious truth. Every legal system assumes that this is part of the employment relationship, and when you violate the duty of loyalty, you don't get beaten up, but you do get terminated when you violate it enough that the employer feels that you're no longer acting in their best interest. We'll go on to the next case, which is a more standard divorce case. We'll do case number one. Who should pay who money? The answer is the teacher's employment was proper. There is no obligation for the yeshiva to compensate the teacher for the loss on employment insurance, and that's it. That's a fascinating question. So if the teacher says, look, this written assertion of absenteeism is much more harmful to me than a truthful assertion of a violation of the duty to loyalty, we would probably say to the school what you have to do, that you have to amend your employment denial form to state the truth. It could very well be that we would require that kind of amendation if the victim of it felt that the truth was more harmful than a falsehood. Case number two, we'll do the first case. Want to read it?
One, a husband, 57, and a wife, 55, have been married for 27 years and are getting divorced. There are three children from this marriage, the youngest of whom is 21, and thus custody matters are not relevant. Wife has been working as husband's assistant in his law office for 15 years. Husband's income is $275,000, and the couple's net worth is $3,200,000, $1 million of which is in the pension. Nearly all accumulated from the husband's law practice. The cost of the wife's standard living is between $55,000 and $75,000 per year, and the wife's income potential is no more than $27,000 per year. They request the help of the Beis Din in dividing up the assets. There is no allegation of fault. Consider also who, if anyone, should have to pay for the graduate education of the children.
So here we have a very good starting point to correct rule. Husband comes in and says, I know what I need to do as a matter of Jewish law. I need to pay my wife the ksuba and help her move out. That's what he says. When we got married, we signed the ksuba, tell me how much I have to pay her, and that's what she's entitled to. So we all understand that as a matter of Jewish law, that isn't correct. And I want to explain to you why, because it's not just enough to understand that it's not correct. It's important to understand why it isn't correct. And the answer goes as follows. Neither the husband nor the wife, at the time of the signing of the ksuba, intended for the monetary payments described in the ksuba to govern their divorce. And although we do still continue to sign a ksuba, neither party in the United States treats this as the financial document that governs their divorce. Why we then sign a ksuba and how it works is a fascinating question. If you go on the internet and you type ksuba in Jewish law, Rabbi Reese and I had an article together about it. You can read the article, but it's sufficient to note that the simple, straightforward answer that Poskim gave throughout the centuries doesn't reflect the custom and practice in America, which is parties don't negotiate over the exit payment in the ksuba. If you go to Israel, by the way, they do negotiate. And the proof is when you buy an Israeli ksuba, the amount of money that's the blank, the line of tsuba with the amount of money mentioned is left blank. And people fill it in, and not only that, they don't write Zuzin. Zuzin is very abstract money. When you try to get on the bus, I'm offering the bus driver two Zuzin, he says he won't take them. They write Shekalim, or they write dollars. Maybe now they write euros. Who knows? But we in America, you go to a wedding and you have a pre-printed ksuba which says Matayim Zakukim Kesef Tsaruf, a fascinating sum of money that refers to the way coins were done in the year 1450 in Bulgaria. And so it's intuitive from this formulation of the halakha that neither the husband nor the wife intended for this document to govern their end of the marriage disagreement. And Rabbi Feinstein famously observes this in a very well thought out tshuva. It's not the first, the Rama really observes it, he's not the last. So the husband's simple answer, which is, well, he agreed about this before we were married. I'll pay her whatever the tshuva says I should pay her, is not the correct answer. The question then becomes, what is the correct answer? And that's a very good question. That's a very good question. And to some extent, Jewish law answers this by looking at the parties. If you come from a place and a time and a sociology where the social norm within the community is to use equitable distribution, the Beis Din might very well use a form of equitable distribution. Certainly, if you signed a prenuptial agreement using equitable distribution as the basis for your assets, the Beis Din would certainly use equitable distribution in such a case. If you go on the Beis Din of America webpage to the standard prenup that we use, one of the options you give people is to check equitable distribution as a method of asset distribution. Since the ketubah doesn't tell us what's the proper method of asset distribution, we don't have a firm, obvious foundation for what we're supposed to use, and we try to retrospectively determine what is the intent of the parties at the time that they married. This is a very bad construct, you should know, but it's the one that's used throughout the Bate Din in New York, or really in the United States, because we can't get people to discuss the details of divorce in advance, and all attempts, for obvious reasons, by the way, all attempts to reformulate the tshuva to require this negotiation in the construct of the tshuva don't readily work. And you shouldn't be surprised to discover that in California, the Bate Din use communal property and not equitable distribution. Not because the Shulchan Aruch says something different in California than it says in New York, but because the norm in California when couples get married is not equitable distribution and it's not the tshuva, it's communal property, because that's what the well-respected California Supreme Court has mandated to be the law in California. Let's turn to problem number three.
What was the
if it's not equitable? And of course, if they had a prenuptial agreement that says something else, the Beis Din would treat this as any normal contract dispute would be resolved, according to, consistent with the terms of the contract, whatever the contract might be. Number three, can you continue to read number three? Great voice, number two. Number three.
Okay. Husband 50 and wife 50 have been married for 23 years and are getting divorced. There are four children from this marriage, ages 21, 19, 16, and 12. Husband and wife are both school teachers with incomes of about $70,000 each. There are no assets to speak of, less than $20,000, other than a house worth $370,000 with a mortgage of $50,000 left on it, with monthly payments of $1,100. Wife alleges, but cannot prove, that the husband is an adulterer and is entered marriage for that reason. Husband denies the allegation. The two older children are out of the house, and the 16-year-old will be soon. The 12-year-old son suffers from a moderate learning disability and is a complex child. They request the help of the Beit Din in resolving the main disputes. Wife very much wishes to stay in the house, which is where they have lived for the past 17 years. Wife also asks in private whether she should simply stay married to him, given the fact that he is an adulterer.
So the last question is a very important one, and the Beis Din normally responds to this by saying, this is a question you have to ask the shul rabbi. What do I mean by that? Successful Bate Din in America recognize that there's a line between what a shul rabbi does and what a Beis Din does. Shul rabbis answer questions of Jewish law that involve a single party and their concerns, and they typically don't answer questions of Jewish law that have two parties that are antagonistic to them. On the other hand, Bate Din tend not to answer pastoral questions, and Bate Din tend not to answer questions that involve a matter of Jewish law that can be best adjudicated by a shul rabbi knowing the reality of the parties in front of them. And this is the kind of question where the Beis Din would say, this is a really, really, really important question, but it's not a question you should ask the Dayanim and the Beis Din. This is a question that you need to answer by going to a rabbi who knows your reality, your situation, and gives you the best advice suited for you. It's important to understand that what they did don't answer all questions of Jewish law. We run a website, we answer many questions. It's not unusual to get an email at 2 in the morning, and the text of the email says, I reached into the Milton drawer, took out a knife, stuck it in the mustard, used the mustard to put on the pastrami, can I eat it? And the best normally emails back say, ask your local rabbi. Not because the Dayanim aren't competent to answer these questions, but because it's not the job of the Beis Din. We don't hasken Yoredei HaShavuos for the community, not because they're unimportant, but because these are the job of shul rabbis and nobody else.
Is the answer obvious on the last question? I mean, it's clear that they're not allowed to remain together.
The answer is not clear. I don't want to deal with it here, but the answer is not clear.
Quite obvious that the rabbi and the husband have a very close relationship. He's a strong Talmud of it, and there's no.
So she should ask somebody else, but it's not being. We don't tell her who to ask, but it's not a question for a Beis Din. It's a question for a rabbi who you have a connection with, who you feel comfortable asking these kinds of questions to. It's not necessarily your shul rabbi. It's not the job of Dayanim, qua Dayanim, to answer these kinds of questions. This case is a little bit more complex than the previous case, because here it touches directly on a central job of what they did, which is Beis Din Aviyim Shel Yitomim. The job of the Beis Din is to serve as the guardian for children when nobody is watching out for them, and that role is taken very seriously by the Beis Din. There is a 12-year-old child here. It's most important in the course of the divorce that the child be properly taken care of and be allowed to grow and develop with a reasonable amount of opportunity. And the Beis Din adjudicates financial and custody disputes consistent with the best interests of the child. So figuring out the exact answer to this case requires much more testimonial evidence than we could quickly review here. But it's clear that the needs of the child, maybe because he has some issues to remain in his house, maybe because he has some issues to remain in school, maybe because he has some issues to remain in a relatively stable context, or maybe to move. These would be a very heavy factor in determining what's the proper resolution of this kind of case, even though this child is at some technical level not a party here. This is a divorce proceeding between a husband and a wife. When it touches on the wants and wishes of children who are in need of help, protection, assistance, in such a situation, the Beis Din serves first and foremost as the guardian of children when their parents aren't protecting them, and that would weigh heavily on the minds of the Dayanim in determining, for example, should the house be sold, should the parents move, how far away should they be allowed to move to, how uninvolved or involved should they remain in the life of their children. These are very hard questions. You have to realize that it's not unusual in our secular society that the casualty of easy divorce is not the husband and not the wife, but the children. And we recognize this intensely, and to the extent that there's burden shifting in a halakhic system of divorce, we try to make sure that the secular model, I teach family law at Emory, because it's a very fascinating business. The secular model shifts problems downward, which is it encourages parents to do their best to get out and dump the tzaras on their children. We try very hard to shift things upward so that when there is difficulty to go around, we'd rather the mother and the father bore it than to have the 12-year-old child bear the difficulties associated with the end of his parents' marriage. It's no easy situation, and no matter what you do, it might very well be that bad happens here. Frequently, the best outcome of family law in Torah is making sure that bad happens to people who can bear it best, and not necessarily bad happening to those who are weakest and least capable of dealing.
Leaving aside whether I think it works on a practical level.
Right,
in a secular system, in many secular systems, a child would be entitled to an attorney in this sort of context. Yeah. Is there ever a situation in a Beis Din where a child would have their own advocate?
We would never appoint an attorney, but we do sometimes appoint a guardian ad litem. And never would we hear such a case without having a clinical psychologist intimately involved, whose primary job would be to advocate for the best interests of the children. Sometimes the clinical psychologist served as a member of a Bethesda, sometimes he served as an advisor for the Latter. You can't really resolve this case without bringing somebody in to give you a real heads up for not children, but what's in the best interest of this specific child and not any other child that's out there. If you don't do that, you're more or less wasting your time, meaning you're not wasting your time, you're just not doing good as opposed to doing good. Last question on this one, and then we'll go on.
It's a proven adulthood. This doesn't weigh heavily on
it. It certainly does. It certainly does. That wasn't the case that was here. That was not the case that was here. So we haven't discussed in this construct how to deal with adultery. Certainly, fault is sometimes considered in the end of marriage adjudication. As a general proposition, people who are faultless in the ending of their marriage, who are in a dispute with somebody who's faulted, do better in bed, because we do consider fault. Next case. Can I get a reader for the next case? No, the next, turn the page, please. You got it.
Okay, they're happily married and have many wonderful children. Leah's 42 and Ruben's 53. Based on their understanding of the halakha, and after consulting with their local Orthodox rabbi last year, Leah and Ruben decided to stop having children, a decision they are both comfortable with for many different reasons. Leah recently needed some therapy. The physical therapist, when speaking to Leah about the consequences of this therapy, stated that while this therapy, which would last for 18 months, Leah would not be fertile, which did not bother Leah one whit. Indeed, Leah would be weak, as she no longer had to bother using any method of contraception. 19 weeks after the therapy began, Leah suspected that she was pregnant, and this was confirmed by a test which indicated that she was 7 weeks pregnant. Leah was surprised by this, and when she spoke to a physical therapist about this, the therapist, after checking and double-checking, agreed that his original assertion to Leah was wrong, and that the course of treatment that Leah is on merely reduces the likelihood of conception but does not make a person infertile. He apologized for his error. Leah has inquired of the Beis Din as to whether she has a cause of action in Jewish law against a therapist, and if so, what is the measure of the damage?
Meaning Leah says, I'm bearing all sorts of consequences from this bad piece of advice. The most obvious of these consequences is I'm 43, soon to be 44, and pregnant. And we thought that this stage in our life was past us. Children are enormously expensive. Tuition goes up and up every year, and I want damages from the therapist for what they call in secular law wrongful life.
Is this real?
Yeah, these come up. People are real. People are incredibly interesting people. The joy of serving on a Beis Din is the interesting people to me. I'm not going there right now. So the question is, even though the therapist gave what we could reasonably call a malpractice piece of advice, how do you go about thinking about whether there are damages to this piece of advice? The therapist says, well, I did make a mistake, but thank God there were no adverse consequences. On the other hand, the husband and wife say, what are you talking about? There is very clearly an adverse consequence. I walk around with the adverse consequence every day. To which the therapist says, that's not an adverse consequence, that's a
blessing.
That's a blessing. To which the woman says, well, will you help me pay for this blessing? To which the therapist says, I'll pay for the blessing if you give me custody of the child. Because after all, the reason why I pay for day school tuition for my children is because when I grow old and frail, I'm looking forward to them paying for my nursing home care. What do I mean by that? The Gemara tells us it's called being a futuriyada. People say to themselves, I'm going to invest in my children because my children will invest in me. When I need somebody to lean on, I'm going to call my children and my children will help me. My children will help me. So, of course, we invest in our children and our children, we hope, invest in us. Of course. So the therapist says, you can't ask me to pay for the children and get no nachas out of them. I'll pay for the children, but then, so to speak, they're mine. To which the Lay and Ruben say, that's ridiculous. They're ours. To which the therapist says, well, that's it. Then we've entered into the realm of an impossible measure of damages. So this is a very question the consensus among folks whom I've spoken to. This isn't a written down thought. And I think my own intuition as well is there's no damages in this case for raising another child. The only measure of damages we would see in this kind of case is the actual cost associated with the birth. So if Leah had said, for example, well, I took myself off of a health insurance plan and had a low deductible for birth because I didn't expect to get pregnant, and now the cost of the birth are I have to pay a $600 deductible for having a child. So you would have to pay $600. But when Leah says, and what about the $270,000 in tuition payment that I'm going to have to make for the next 20 years? Because being a Jewish child, I'm sure he's going to go to Yeshiva University at, you know, right now I think you have a son here is $28,000 a year. And by the time this child turns into an adult, it'll be $48,000 a year. You're talking about bucks, big bucks, which we say, gosh, that's a very hard calculus to make because you invest in those children and you get nachas from them. Ah, now you want to change the facts and make the case much harder, which is something goes wrong. That's a very hard case. I don't want to deal with that case here. That's a very hard case, which is if something had gone wrong here, it might very well be that the measure of damages are much more complex because the basic virtue and vice becomes different. It's an excellent question. And it touches on many other matters like abortion, a very complicated conversation, not for now.
Would Jewish logic account of the fact that the child wouldn't want to necessarily know that a case was filed about this because you said that Jewish law puts the child's interest higher than the parent?
Sure, now you want to make the case even harder. Maybe issuing an award here is sort of like taking a red stamp out and sticking it in the ink pad and stamping on the child's head unwanted or mistake. I'm not sure that that's correct because parents have a way of hiding these facts from their children. Meaning many parents have children where the first thought that comes to their mind is they should name the child accident. But in the end, they grow up and love the child and they hide this fact from their children's rooms. But I don't think that that's intrinsically necessarily so. Sure, it's a medical malpractice issue at some level, but the central question is one of damages. The central question, obviously what's happening here is a mistake. The question here is not about whether this is good or bad. The question is about how do you measure the damages in these kinds of cases. By the way, in American law, you'll find courts that give awards for unwanted life. This is exactly a tension between Jewish law and American law. We tend not to think life is unwanted. On the other hand, you'll find American law cases who say no, no, no. Leah has to mitigate damages by having an abortion.
Oh, yeah.
Both of those are perspectives that Jewish law would run to. That's a fascinating question. The question was you have to bring med mal cases to Bezdin. And the simple answer is most medical malpractice cases are fundamentally between a physician and between the physician's insurance company and the patient. They're not centrally between the physician at all. Just like automobile accident cases are not customarily heard by the public because they're essentially governed by insurance law. In those rare cases where that would not be the case, it might well be that there'll be situations where the matter should be brought in front of Bezdin. It's unusual that such cases arise. This is the kind of case, though, that it does arise in because the American was at such a completely different moral place. Meaning, how much the damages are for the dentist who pulls out the wrong tooth. At the end of the day, both Jewish law and American law really recognize that pulling out the wrong tooth is bad. Here, you're dealing with something that has a value-driven activity. Some American law states say they should mitigate damages by having an abortion, a hard answer for the Jewish tradition to put forward. Some American law states don't know. They lay it in suit for full and complete damages because every new child is bad. That's also an approach that the Jewish tradition has a hard time accepting. This is the kind of case that ends up in Besdin because both parties very well understand that how you resolve this case very much is about your moral view towards having more children and the unavailability of abortion functionally. I guess we have to go on. I don't mind taking questions afterwards, but if we stop to take questions about all of them, well, we never go through the curriculum. Next case, can I get somebody to read? Please.
Husband has been a member of the OLA Synagogue for 28 years. He and his first wife joined when they moved into the neighborhood soon after their marriage. Husband and first wife divorced 8 years ago and first wife moved from the neighborhood. Husband has since remarried to second wife, whom he is now separated from and in the process of divorcing in a bitterly contested divorce. OTPE has assigned seats on the high holidays, with each member unit assigned 2 free seats. And husband has asked that his seats not be assigned to his estranged wife, but to his daughter from his first marriage, who is now 23, and by the bylaws of the synagogue would otherwise have to purchase a room seat. Wife states that the seat is hers, and she wants the seat that she has sat in since the marriage. Synagogue has family membership, and wife's current seat was used by first wife before her. Husband purchased the rights to those 2 seats in perpetuity for the high holidays when the new building was built 14 years ago for $12,000. Is husband or wife entitled to these seats?
So as of right now, this is an easy question because they're still married, and although they might be fighting a bitterly contested divorce, wife, there's a family membership, and the family membership is for a husband and a wife, and she is the wife. Thus, she is entitled to these seats because she fits the prima facie contractual criteria for this. This is a husband seat and a wife seat, and although they might be angry at each other and they might be fighting in general, we would never jump the gun and say that the seats that belong to the wife in this situation shouldn't go to the person who's the wife, both as a matter of Jewish law and as a matter of American law, because she is, in fact, a wife. They could reconcile, or they could develop some other process for resolving this dispute. We would indeed turn to them and say it would be proper, as you get divorced, if you could address this question in the course of your divorce. But we frequently say this to people when they laugh, meaning they're incapable of divvying up anything amicably after they possibly divvy up this one as well. When the divorce is final and the get is given, who owns the seats? Everything is now over, and they're just fighting about these 2 seats in the synagogue. And here it's important to understand the Jewish law principle as well. As a general proposition, absent an agreement from the parties to the contrary, assets that you bring into a marriage remain with you when the marriage ends through divorce. Since these 2 seats were purchased by the husband and his first wife, and when he divorced his first wife, she didn't take the seat with him, but she gave it back to him. He had these 2 seats upon his initial entry into his marriage with his second wife. Absent an agreement with the second wife, these 2 seats would go to him. Now, this is not a standard ownership, right? Because he doesn't own the seats such that he can come into the synagogue with a screwdriver and take his seats home to his house. You don't buy ownership to synagogue seats like you buy ownership to a couch. But nonetheless, you have vested rights in them, and these vested rights in them are considered in halacha to be a form of ownership sufficient that it would follow the general rules associated with owning property as a matter of Jewish law, and actions agreeing between them as to how to divide up the assets, he would get the seats under the assumption that the assets came into him, were his before the marriage, and absent the agreement to the contrary, they remain his. Next case, just because we're running out of time, I'm glad to stick around afterwards and answer questions. I don't need to 12 people, but I also want to cover some more material. Can I get another reader?
A man in his early 40s is diagnosed with premature Alzheimer's, an illness that causes the premature onset of senility. The doctors involved state that over the next 5 years, his mental all of his mental capacity, and by the time he's 50, he will have no knowledge of his surroundings or family and will be incompetent. Currently, he is fully mentally alert. After the onset of senility, this man, with reasonable care, could live a normal lifespan, 30 more years, albeit mentally unaware and living in a sanatorium. Degrees of senility comes in waves for people with premature Alzheimer's. Husband and wife are in the basement seeking information on divorce. They are happily married and in love. She is worried that when he becomes senile, she will be trapped in a dead marriage from which she can derive no benefit from, but yet cannot marry another. The couple does not desire to be divorced now, as each still loves the other. He, too, does not really wish for her to be trapped in a dead marriage after he is in a sanatorium, fully incompetent and unaware of the community around him. However, he would like to be married for as long as he is mentally alert. According to Jewish law, a man cannot authorize a get to be given to his wife when he is mentally incompetent.
This is just a plain old, hard, unpleasant case. The Bezdin deals with lots of just hard, unpleasant cases. There's no excellent or even great solution to this problem. They themselves don't know what's the right solution here because they desire to remain together until just the right moment, and not a moment before that, but not many moments after that. And if they wait too long, you know what happens?
They'll
be stuck. On the other hand, if they wait not enough, so life will be miserable and guilt-racked for both of them.
How is that different from a soldier that goes to war, a married soldier goes to war?
Oh, for the married soldier that goes to war, you assume that either he's coming back or he's not coming back.
He's not coming back mentally.
I understand that, but he's here right now. He's here right now. He's here right now. It's a different kind of situation. This is just a difficult situation. There's no excellent halachic answer. You shouldn't think that there's a solution here that leaves everybody fully and completely content. You have to decide whether you want to err on the side of caution or not. The practice in these kinds of cases, I sense, and there aren't so many of them, and they're very, very, very hard cases, is when marital intimacy ceases to be an issue for the couple, that's when a get is given, and we'll let them continue to act as if they're a married couple after the get is given, even as intimacy is no longer proper, is no longer possible given the reality of this particular case. But there's no good solution at all to this case, and even the soldier's issue, you know, is very hard. Notwithstanding the fact that there is a get milchama procedure out there, it is not used. It's not used in Israel. How come? I have a son who's a soldier in a combat brigade right outside Shchem. My son likes to joke, it's within stone throw of Shchem and they throw stones. But nobody finds a get milchama. How come? Because husbands turn to wives and say there are two alternatives. Either I'm coming back, or I'm not. And one way or another, wait until you know the answer. Wait until you know the answer. If I come back, it's nice that you're here. And if I'm not coming back, so I'm not coming back. Husbands are uncomfortable and unhappy with the notion that they might be coming back, but while they're someplace else, their wife should marry another. There seems to be good reason why normal people would find that demoralizing. So the middle of the Eretz Yisrael is notwithstanding the presence of Gitei Milchama on some theoretical level, nobody uses them because they're in fact demoralizing. This is a hard case. Now, you know, one of the things you discover in the Bezdin business is hard cases don't always have great resolutions, and sometimes they're just problematic. And in this kind of case, what you say to the couple is what you really want to do is when marital intimacy ceases being something that's expected, that's the time to come in and give a get, but you need to err on the side of giving the get early, because you can't err on the side of giving the get late. If you err on the side of giving the get late, because the husband is no longer mentally competent at the time of the giving of the get, then you know what? There won't be a get given at all.
If he went to the shaliach, was
or an intimate agent. There's a general principle of Jewish law which goes as follows. I can't appoint an agent to do something that I myself am legally prevented from doing.
Even if I could when I appointed.
So, for example, if I were to appoint this fine man to buy me a box of raspberries, and I gave him the money, and I sent him on the way, and then I died. So my agency to him would automatically end at the moment of my death, since that would preclude me from buying raspberries, that would preclude him from buying raspberries as my agent.
Does the best ever suggest a schedule of competency tests?
Each of these cases gets done on a case-by-case basis. Of course, it has to have ongoing competency tests, but you have to figure out how to deal with this and not intrude on people as they head off to the sunset. Meaning, there's a pastoral element here also, which is nobody wants to be nudnik into their death.
Is it the same for a woman? Can she receive again if she's mentally competent?
No. It's the same for a woman. There's a different procedure called the heter meir rabanan, which makes this case a little bit easier in cases of mental incompetence by the woman. I don't want to deal with that now. I guess I want to do one more case, and then we'll go on.
Can I just mention something? My neighborhood, the exact same thing came up. He was in his 30s. But they themselves agreed to it, that he would give her a gift. He moved there in Cicero, and they visited him all the time. It was sort of a happy family until he was no longer competent to...
Doesn't sound so happy, but okay. I don't know. I don't have a problem with that solution. That's what they want. One more case and then we'll go on. Next case. Can I get a reader? You work here. You want to work again? That's great.
Ruga and Rachel are seeking to get married and they arrange with a florist to do the flowers for the wedding at a cost of $2,470, half in advance and half after the wedding. On the day of the wedding, the florist does not show up, and notwithstanding any number of frantic phone calls, the florist simply never shows up. The wedding proceeds anyway and the couple are now happily married. After Shabbat Brachot, the newlyweds contact the florist, who tells them that he is a sole proprietor and that the morning of the wedding his own father died, and thus he could not do the wedding. He was very sorry and gladly offered to refund their down payment of $1,237.50. The couple is contacted to ask if they have any other remedy besides simply a refund. The wedding they deal was bare and makes them unhappy that their wedding was without any flowers. They would like $5,000 for the florist.
So this is a very important case. First of all, contrary to what any of you think, as a matter of Jewish law, you can get married without flowers. So this case is different than if, for example, the rabbi had not shown up. If the rabbi doesn't show up and thus nobody can do the wedding, the rabbi might, in some situations, be liable for damages. I want to deal with that case, but flowers are the caterer. These are all things that you don't really need to get married. You don't need them to get married. On the other hand, the couple does feel that the wedding was missing something. On the other hand, their request for $5,000 is without any basis. They could have just as well said $5 million, or $500,000, or $50,000 is $5,000, and they have no foundation for this in Jewish law. Having said that, they ask a follow-up question, which is, okay, we have no foundations. Can we repeat this information to our peers? Which is, we used Joe the florist. We gave him half down. He didn't show up for the wedding. He says something because his father died. You should know his mother's still alive. And what they're saying now is they want to know, can they repeat their bad story? And then they say something different. They say, can we tell the florist that unless he gives us $5,000, you know what we're going to do? Repeat the bad story. So now they want to use the Besdin process to get money back they're not entitled to. Now this is very important. And here's an overlap between a Lashon Hara problem. Let me just finish. A Lashon Hara problem and a Besdin problem. When I have a bad experience with a merchant, I am allowed to repeat it, and that's not Lashon Hara. Not only is that not Lashon Hara, it's frequently obligatory to do. So when I hire a person and he paints my house, and he does a bad job painting my house, and you come to me and say, you hired Joe the painter, did he do a good job? It's sinful for me to say he did a good job, because it leads you astray. And that speaking is mandatory. speaking is mandatory. It's not lashon hara. It's mandatory speaking that we're all obligated to do when we encounter somebody who's a fraud or grossly incompetent. But that's not what they want to do here. What they want to do here is they want to use the threat of that speaking not to warn everybody else about the flaws, but to do what? To enrich themselves. And here, the Besdin is pretty clear that while we would say to people, if you feel this Floris did such a horrible job that you have to share with people the wrong that he did, you might be allowed to do that, but you would not in any way, shape, or form be allowed to use the threat of doing that as a way to dig for money that you're not entitled to. You are allowed to repeat that information if it's important and necessary. Not only are you allowed to, you should. You should. A person does a poor job. You need to repeat it to people who go to you and say, you use this person, did he do a good job? But you can't use the threat of repeating this information as a way of getting paid. So they're still not entitled to that money at all. I think that if the parties wanted to work out that kind of a compromise, the Besdin wouldn't stand in opposition to that compromise, but it's money shalokin in. It's just money that they're not entitled to as a matter of normative Jewish law because they have no damages present.
Can they say that if we had known we were going to get this no-frills way, we would have just gone totally bare-bone and paid a couple $1,000 for the cheapest thing on the market instead of our, you know, $60,000 extravaganza asking for the difference?
The answer is that the claim doesn't do its core work because it's not a consequential damage from the lack of flowers. That might be different if the the rabbi didn't show up or some other essential component didn't show up.
Hasn't this now become a criminal act?
No, it's not extortion at all as a matter of American law. It happens that it's not something a lawyer can advocate, but it's not extortion at all as a matter of American law. That's a good question and a fascinating legal ethics issue there as well, but not for now. You mean now they've extorted, but they're going through a vow of repentance. I think that once you squeeze money from somebody, the whole construct then becomes shalokin din. It would be a very nefarious and unpleasant thing.
Are they still obligated to
no.
additional future victims?
No, because they're already become a negated the dogma in this activity. It's 11:30, we've gone our full hour. We have one more problem left, which we won't get to do. It's a pleasure. Those of you who want to follow up with me, I'll either be around here or you can email me. I don't think it matters.
Let's say you're a rabbi in the yeshiva, and families come over to you and ask about the yeshiva.
Yeah,
friend, and you can't say, I'm yeshiva A, but your son would do better in yeshiva.
Not without permission from your employer.
Really? I don't think
no, but it's around here. No. But if you can't be going here, I mean.
Rabbi Roy, it's a pleasure to meet you. We've heard about you for before. Our son is Danny Rabbit.
Thank you.
Oh, great.
Very highly.
Good to meet you.
How does Jewish law treat whistleblowing in relation to loyalty?
About a criminal act? I think you can always report your employer if he's doing something criminal. But you have to distinguish between an act of disloyalty and a criminal act. Of course, you're in a yeshiva and you're a day school and the principal is running a sideline selling cocaine to the kids, there's no duty of loyalty. So of course. But you're talking about that's the difference between a profound breach and a small breach. But I have to run because I'm giving another class. Yes.
I'm missing something in the last case. I don't understand the foundation for the whole question. I mean, the guy's father died. It's beyond his control.
Well, but that doesn't matter to some extent in the following sense. Onus, I mean, if I pledge to do something to you, and you suffer
something
from
beyond your control,
I don't think it matters normally. I think it matters. Where do I go now? Do you know?
Downstairs.
301. Thank you.
I think you disregard that situation.
No, but I don't think it matters in the following sense. When I turn to you,
I'm not on this.